Hi, this is Andrew Fisher, RPG developer at Fantasy Flight Games. You're listening to the Grim Dark Podcast, the best 40k podcast around.
Thought for the day. Life is the Emperor's currency. Spend it well. Hello, brothers and sergeant, and welcome to episode 23 of the Grim Dark Podcast. This is James.
And this is Mike.
If you're coming to us for the first time, we're a podcast devoted to role-playing in the 41st millennium, particularly using the role-playing systems created by Fantasy Flight Games. Each episode, we talk about one of the game systems. In tonight's case, it'll be Death Watch. But before we jump into the episode brief, let's just quickly talk about our week in gaming, or our week in non-gaming, because realistically speaking, we only got back halfway through this week from our trip to Gen Con in the US. As you probably know, our last episode was a little bit late because we recorded it after Gen Con. I had to do a week of work in New York, and we've only just got back Sunday this week, and I think we're both still a bit jet-lagged. Mike, you're looking pretty tired there.
Yeah.
But we also had our regular Tuesday night game, which just didn't go off. Everybody pulled out last minute, so we literally have not gamed since Gen Con.
Yes.
But we're still ready to talk about the game settings anyway. In tonight's show, what are we talking about? So I mentioned before, it's Death Watch. We'll do our regular news section. Not a lot of news tonight. I guess everyone's still a bit sort of overwhelmed after the awesomeness that was Gen Con. But there is a bit to talk about. Given that we're talking about Death Watch, we're going to talk a bit about the system of renown and also honours for Death Watch. We're going to do a review of the Tactical Marine. Talk about builds, especially how the alternate options as such. We'll review the book Emperor's Chosen. And then finally, there's a topic that Mike's wanted to do for a while, which is talking about ways to manage game downtime, particularly blue booking as a concept.
Yeah.
And after that, we'll do our regular community section and close out the show. So, Mike, are you awake enough to do this tonight?
Yes.
All right, let's do it.
Command acknowledged. Accessing Imperial Archives.
So, as I mentioned earlier, there's not a lot of news today, particularly out of FFG. In fact, there's basically no new news since our last show. I mean, Dark Heresy 2nd Ed release was the last bit of news for 40K. There's a lot of, I guess, Star Wars news and a lot of the other sort of announcements they made at the in-flight presentation we saw at Gen Con.
Yep.
But I guess we've got to wait for a little bit before we start hearing more about Forgotten Gods or other books that are in the works for the settings at all. But there has been some other news from Games Workshop particularly. So, as Mike mentioned in our last episode, Codex Grey Knights has been released along with some new Grey Knights. I'm not sure how new the figures are. I guess they're probably plastic versions of older metal figures. There is a dedicated Land Raider for Grey Knights now, which has the Nemesis pattern bolters. The side cannons. The side cannons on the top pintle mount rather than the standard bolters.
Yep.
But it's got the las cannon arrangement, so still a bit different from my Grey Knights Land Raider Crusader, which has the Forge World doors in front, but still a nice model, nonetheless. And there's actually a Nemesis Vanguard box set, which is, I think, a few items to make up your basic Grey Knights army. The good thing about a Grey Knights army is you can do a lot of army points-wise with not many models.
Yes.
Yeah, they're quite expensive figures, especially by the time you start putting in Nemesis Dread Knights and vehicles as well, you know.
I don't really think much of the Dread Knight.
No, I mean, it's a relatively recent addition to the game.
Yeah.
I wonder what the benefit of it really is versus the Dreadnought. It's open-topped, so it's got that issue, I guess, as well. I mean, I've never fielded one in the game to see what they're actually like. I'll admit that.
Yeah.
Are you talking about just the model you don't like or the concept in general?
It's more the model I don't like.
Okay.
Yeah, and to be honest, from a game point of view, I have to agree with you. I think the Dreadnought will probably be better anyway.
Yeah, that's it.
Better looking model, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I love the current Dreadnoughts. Do you remember the old Dreadnoughts, the ones that look like a sort of a tin can? They were more like what the Killer Cans look like now.
Yeah,
it's going back to like the old yellow and red book days of 40K.
But
I mean, there's some nice figures out for Grey Knights. Other bit of news out of Games Workshop is there's another computer game that's been announced, or actually a phone game. So yeah. Horus Heresy Drop Assault was announced in, I think, June or July for iOS and Android devices, being made by Complex Games. It's a sort of a tactical game. It's being touted right now as a free-to-play. Potentially, you may find it's like a freemium model where you can play it for free, but you can get ahead a lot faster if you
were throw to in buy some more real world dollars.
Yeah, yeah. Look, we don't know if that's the case. It's just, you know, it's hard to put a lot of money into developing a free iOS game or such Android game without some way of getting revenue back out of it again, I suppose.
Yeah.
But we'll wait and see. I actually found out about this because I've mentioned from Eternal Crusade's website change. So they had recently had a website update, and it actually read like patch notes for an MMO, actually. But one of the comments was they were changing some nomenclature around what they called things to avoid creating confusion with the game Horus Heresy Drop Assault. So, look, I mean, the current live streams for Eternal Crusade are like 2 hours each. So, and a lot of them are Q&A. So, it's been hard for us to cover every single live stream's contents on each episode. So, if you're listening to hear more about Eternal Crusade, check out their actual their live streams on YouTube.
Yep.
Because there's lots of good information there. The one thing I'll point out, by the way, is that it actually recently won an award from MMORPG.com as the most anticipated MMO. So, you know, a nice little bit of kudos there for the team at Eternal Crusade.
Yeah.
Now, that's really it for news, unless you've got anything else you want to add.
Not really, no.
Okay, no worries. Well, let's get into the meat of our show.
Knowledge is power. Hide it well.
Welcome to our Death Watch discussion for the day. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be talking today about the Renown system and the Honors system. Now, let me start off by saying that the Renown system in Death Watch is one of those systems where when you look at it from the outside, you think, okay, this is a nicely thought out, good system for tracking character development above and beyond just experience points.
Yep.
In application, where we've actually played the games, I've sort of found it to be more of a hindrance. And the reason is that, especially at the starting level, like when everyone's only initiated, there's a lot of gear which is unavailable to you through that. And that means that how you might approach a mission is very different from how you would do it if you had access to more equipment as such. And I guess in some ways it can take out some of the versatility and fun of how you might do a mission. You really got to go down to just brass tacks of the simple, most simple weapons and gear that Marines have, which is pretty much just, you know, run and gun almost. You know, there's less versatility as such. But
yeah,
some people may have found it different. That's just what I found in the games that we played, is that, you know, we're people who were familiar with Space Marines from 40K. We gave the mission, said, okay, this is what you got to do. And Trader, they're going, okay, well, we need a sniper, so someone get a Stalker Pattern Bolt Gun. No, sorry, that's respected level. That sort of thing, you know. So that was probably the one thing that I think held it back at the start. I think that, once again, it's a good in concept. I guess it needs to be managed carefully, especially at low levels, in regards to player expectations by the GM.
I think so. I think really, though, for your first couple of missions, a Bolt Gun should be a good enough weapon to do whatever you're trying to do.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't really have too much trouble in that regards.
Yeah.
You know, if you're throwing people up against into missions where they're trying to do things like sniping and all that sort of stuff, you may want to save that for a little bit later on in the game.
Yeah.
Early missions, try and keep it a little bit more simple, which is probably a good idea as well, just to make sure that everyone's actually comfortable with what their characters can do
and the game. So game things set, like squad mode and solo mode, and then also things like the horde system, they're all relatively new concepts that were introduced with Death Watch. So
but yeah, I have to agree, it can feel a little bit clunky at times, but it is a good thing. It's good in theory, it's just it's a little slow to use.
Alright, so let's start off with what Renown actually is, and I think in some ways the fluff of what Renown is can be relatively contradictory in regards to how the game fluff actually works. So Renown in Death Watch is basically a measure of the character's notoriety. Now, I guess the question comes down to whether you see it as notoriety within Death Watch or notoriety within their chapter / Adeptus Astartes in general. And the reason I say that, we'll come back to it a bit later when we talk about character death. But it talks about the fact that a character can enter the Death Watch with a high renown, which to me implies that that they also regard deeds done outside of the Death Watch as renown-earning things.
Yeah.
But the default position is still that a new player character in Death Watch starts with zero renown. And of course, Death Watch is, in many cases, a a reward for exceptional service of a Marine. You know, the best and brightest are put forward Death Watch. That's not always the case. Some chapters use it as a punishment almost. Some just send a quota of Marines because they're required to ensure the watch is properly staffed as such, you know. But in some cases, it's literally this person has distinguished themselves, and so because of that, we'll give them a tenure in Death Watch where they can become an individual achiever as well as a, you know, a group contributor as such.
Yeah.
But they'll always enter as a player character with zero, or maybe some of the deeds will give you some starting renown, but I think in general, you're going to have very low renown. You know, probably, let's say, under 5 points.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the question of whether it is actually a Death Watch thing or a starter thing came up. And what would you think, like, under those circumstances?
I always sort of looked at it more as an Astarte thing in general. Mm. Sort of, you sort of fame word of mouth amongst all Marines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess it would also depend upon, though, like, what renown is to one chapter might be different from another. So let's imagine you've got a group of Raven Guard, and one of their Marines is well-regarded because he managed to perpetrate a mission to recover a lost relic without engaging enemy forces once. Yeah. You know, he used his amazing stealth skills to completely, you know, bypass enemy patrols and recover the relic. You know, when the Flesh Tearers hear that story, are they going to be impressed, or are they going to be sort of saying, well, why didn't he butcher everyone in his path?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
what's the point of reclaiming the relic if you didn't, you know, cleanse it of the taint of being touched by people who should never have touched it?
Yeah. So I think it could be quite subjective along the same lines as well.
Yeah, I think so. But I think by the same token, if a Raven Guard did butcher everyone who came into contact with the relic before rescuing it,
yes,
other chapters would probably look at them a bit odd and go, well, they don't really seem much like the sort of Raven Guard we've heard of.
Yeah.
And they may feel a bit unsure of that person as well. So it's double-edged in that regard.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what are the actual benefits of having a high renown? So I sort of came across with three, and this is once again, in the case of being in Death Watch, what's good about having high renown? One is that you've got access to more advanced equipment. That's probably the main mechanical advantage in the game, is that a lot of the equipment in the game is gated by what your current renown level is.
Yes.
That removes some of the hostility from the characters, but it also, I guess, it gives a sense of accomplishment in the game. So as your renown goes up, suddenly your character has access to... I mean, the first level respected is really just, I can now use all the other standard gear that I'm used to seeing Marines with.
Yeah.
But above and beyond that, you start to get to some really impressive and versatile gear in terms of things like Thunder Hammers, you know, later on Relics, Terminator Armor, that sort of stuff. It's the sort of stuff that characters would really want to get their hands on, but shouldn't have their hands on at the start of the game. So yeah, the gate does work well there. The second thing is that, although it's not really called out, well, okay, some honours in the game do say that your respect level, or your renown level, needs to be at a certain level before you can get that. And of course, the most common one being the Crux Terminatus. But I think also that a Marine with a high honour has a greater chance of... Sorry, a Marine with a high renown has a greater chance of receiving honours. A lot of the honours talk about things like valorous deeds. And those are also the sort of deeds that would get you renown. So I think that in these cases, honor and renown go hand in hand. You won't see a initiated Death Watch member with a whole stack of honors, because they should have achieved those while doing deeds that also pushed their renown up quite well as well.
Yeah.
And I guess also that the other advantage from a gameplay point of view is a social standing. You know, the Marines respect each other. Even in cases where, and this is one of the sort of the unique facets of the Death Watch, is that you may have a Ultramarine Psyker working alongside a Black Templar who absolutely hates Psykers and gives him, and we've talked about this before, and gives him all sorts of trouble. But if that Psyker has an immense level of renown, you know, the Black Templar should still respect that renown as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. You may still hate what he is, but he doesn't necessarily hate who he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it comes down also between the different chapters which dislike each other as well. Like even the Space Wolves and Dark Angels,
yeah,
renowned for not liking each other. But if they've both got high levels of renown, there'll be some level of acceptance that this is a worthy Marine. They may not like them.
Renown is not about buying friendship. It's about buying respect, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So you can still respect your enemies or respect people that are from backgrounds that may not necessarily match with yours.
Yes, yes.
All right, so in terms of ways to actually gain renown in the game, it opens up a bit when you've got access to more books. So let's just talk about, first off, what is in the core Deathwatch book. You basically get a point of renown for completing all of one type of objective. So if you complete all the primary objectives or all the secondary objectives, or all the tertiary objectives, you get 1 point of renown for each of those.
Yeah.
On top of that, you've also got another point for completing 5 objectives of any type. So even if you didn't complete all the primary objectives, if you completed the total of 5 objectives between primary, secondary, and tertiary, there's an extra point there. And then also if you achieve 3 objectives that are considered to be veteran objectives. So, and a lot of those will require, you know, individual achievement. Literally, you know, a person needs to go and do one substantial thing and you can get renowned for that as well. And on top of that, there's basically a GM choice of up to 3 points for just quote-unquote acts of bravery and heroism. Now, I guess that's one of those things where as a GM you've got to sort of decide what is your level of tolerance for what is an act of bravery or heroism. And I certainly think, at least if I was doing it, I would make that requirement more and more stringent as it went on, particularly as the character's renown got quite high.
Definitely. I think there is a fair level of control over this as well, because it will be quite easy for characters just to rack up the renown quite quickly. And a good way of controlling it is to make it that some of the objectives actually clash.
Yeah.
So you could have one of the primary objectives to kill the leading enemy Psyker. A secondary objective could be to capture the leading enemy Psyker. Obviously, you cannot kill them and capture them at the same time.
Yeah.
Therefore, they won't be able to get all of the renown that's completely available to them. And if you position them in that way, you can make it that you're not giving out dozens and dozens of renown every single mission.
Now, if you've also got access to Rites of Battle, which is one thing we've always said is that the next book you should buy after Deathwatch, then you've also got, on pages 201 and 202, you've got a whole bunch of additional ways to gain renown, but also now ways to actually lose renown.
Yes.
So losing renown was never really covered in the main book. I mean, I suppose from a theoretical point of view, you could say, okay, well, if you can gain renown, you can lose renown for bad actions. There's actually a set of examples now in Rites of Battle that can cause you to lose renown. So just talking about some of the things that you could gain renown for from Rites of Battle, you got things like the Battle Brother kept his word, even though it was at great cost to himself. The Battle Brother suffered a terrible wound to save a fellow Battle Brother from death. The Battle Brother defeated a numerically superior foe without firing a single shot or landing a single blow, carrying them with his mere presence and forcing them to either surrender or run away in fear. That's a pretty impressive one, you know, and it's worth between 1 and 3 renown. I mean, I suppose that this comes down to those examples like when Marines are sent to pacify Imperial Guard that have rebelled or such. You know, it wouldn't be hard for them to cow a group of Imperial Guard into surrendering or running away, would it?
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's definitely within the realms of possibility, but it's probably quite difficult to do.
Yeah. The biggest one here is while mortally wounded, i.e. suffering from critical damage, the Battle Brother single-handedly saved the rest of his kill team from almost certain destruction. And this, to me, almost seems like one of those situations where...
It's posthumous.
I know, it could have been like, you know, the GM was that close to a TPK, a total party kill, but the one person managed to survive at the end, and so they get this massive renown boost as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
it feels more like if they managed to do something to save absolutely everyone else.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's going to be difficult to do.
That's it. Conversely, some of the things that might cause you to lose renown is failing missions, betraying trust, inadvertently leading to the death of a fellow Marine. Turning down honours. All these various things might cause someone to actually lose renown.
Yeah, and I think the biggest loss one is surrendering to a foe, I believe, which is...
-5, yeah.
Yeah, -5. I mean, surrendering to your enemy.
Yeah, regardless of extenuating circumstances.
Yeah.
So there's no... They brook no
There's no honor in surrender.
That's
And one which is, I don't think is mentioned, there is obviously the loss or destruction of a relic, which is a huge, huge thing.
That's it, yeah. In fact, that really goes beyond the concept of renown, I think. That becomes a plot point.
It does, yeah.
That's right.
But obviously there should be massive renown hits for...
penalties because of that, that's right, yeah. But it'd almost be to the point where, based upon some of the material I've read or listened to in audiobooks, it's almost like a Marine that loses a relic becomes an absolute pariah. It's almost like, you know, renown is reset to zero.
Yeah, there is actually...
until they recover it.
I believe there is a section of it in Rites of Battle about what happens if someone loses a relic.
Yeah.
And it's definitely worthwhile keeping that in mind before you go stealing relics away from characters, because it is a real major point.
Yeah, that's it. Now, you mentioned before as well about posthumous awards. I think almost that I wouldn't worry too much about renown as a posthumous award, because once again, it talks about the respect of the character.
Yeah.
And respect is one of those things that is intangible beyond, you know, the character's lifespan as such. Honours, on the other hand, I would certainly see plenty of reason to bestow honours on a Marine after death.
Yeah.
Because those are tangible awards that can be sort of, okay, well, yes, he received the Crux Terminatus, just not before his final mission as such.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, that's true. I suppose it comes down from that point of view as to how you're going to deal with what happens if a character dies. Do they come back into the game starting at zero? Do they start back at the old level?
Okay, well, let's talk about that, because that's actually talked about at one point in the book, because the way Death Watch work is that if a brother falls in battle, that he needs to be replaced with an individual of equal standing. Yeah. Now, the only key thing is it's usually he's replaced by his chapter. So if an Ultramarine with 60 renown falls, the Ultramarines need to send somebody with around 60 renown in to join it. So that's a good way for you as a player, if you need to make a new character because your old character died, to say, okay, well, I get to, realistically speaking, keep the renown that I had. I don't have to worry about starting again with base equipment. But if you're following the rules, or not the rules, but the fluff exactly, that would also require you to remake a character with the same chapter.
There is also the fact that that's someone given to the Death Watch, not necessarily given to that particular kill team.
That's true. So it could be a case of you saying, well, the Ultramarines in this example replaced that battle brother with somebody else. We've moved him into kill team Omega, and out of Omega we've moved another brother of a similar level into your kill team in order to mix up the, you know, the pool of experience as such.
And it is going to be actually an important point of what you're going to do as the GM when a character dies in this system. Same with Black Crusade as well, with infamy ratings. It's actually something you've got to sit down and think about before you even start playing.
Mm.
What are you going to do when characters die? Because characters die. It happens.
That's it.
And at some stage you're going to have to go, well, do I force them to start again at the bottom where, you know, they're going to then be hampered by not having the same sort of gear as everyone else? They're really going to feel that.
Mm.
And what are you going to do about experience as well?
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, using the examples we spoke about in previous episodes, I mean, usually the way I would handle death in one of these games, for example, would be just, okay, so I would have either decided at the start of the campaign to keep all the characters on a level XP footing.
Yep.
So if somebody can't make a game, they still get XP for that game, so that everybody's always at the same level. Or alternatively, if I do give people XP awards, when a new character has to be built because an old character died, I'll either say
there's a minimum level.
There's a minimum level, which will usually be the starting XP of the lowest rank that the group currently has.
Yep.
So if there's a 3 and 2 4s, it'll be starting at rank 3 at the base level. Or I'll let the person remake a character at the same XP level their old character was at.
Yeah.
But yeah, once again, if you're building now a rank 5 character, it seems incongruous that a rank 5 character would come into Death Watch with zero renown.
Yeah, yes, that's
it.
Exactly.
So it really, I think it is something that should, from a narrative point of view and from a rules point of view, transcend the character's death.
Yes.
And at least there may be, I mean, you know, roll a d10 and plus minus so that it's not exactly the same, but it could be anything along those lines anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just quickly talk about the levels of renown and what that actually means to you in terms of what it does, just even gear-wise. So we mentioned before, initiated is the base level, and this really gives you access to only the most standard gear. So bolters, you know, bolt pistols. If you're a Devastator, then you're pretty much limited to the heavy bolter or the missile launcher.
Yeah.
You know, Kraken frag grenades.
But as I pointed out, you know, a squad of Space Marines with just bolt guns is certainly quite capable of taking out a large group of Imperial Guardsmen or similarly armed Xenos. So yeah. I don't think it's a big deal to say, oh, well, they're going to be armed with garbage, because certainly it's not garbage.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next level up, which is Respected. Now, this one I think is going to give you probably the most versatility in terms of your character. It's going to give you access to pretty much your standard regular gear. So, when I say regular gear, like anything that you would put on a tactical marine in a regular war game of 40K. So,
yeah, I think it's more sort of your mission-specific gear rather than your personalised gear.
Well, most of the plasma weapons, most of the melter weapons, the las cannon, you know, we mentioned the Stalker before, combi weapons, you know, power weapons, force weapons if you're a librarian.
Yeah.
As well as a couple of the nice little pieces of gear like suspensors for heavy weapons, motion predictors, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Next up is Distinguished. And this is going to give you the remainder of your plasma, so your plasma cannon, your plasma grenades, plasma missiles, as well as some of your more advanced melee weapons. So things like lightning claws, power fist, thunder hammer, etc. Also a few of the extra pieces of gear like the psychic hood, once again for the librarian, the signum, targeter, arm weapon mount, all those things are going to come with Distinguished. Next one up is Famed. I guess this is probably the one that most people want to get to, because the main thing that Famed gives you is Terminator armor.
Yes.
Which is probably as far as you're ever going to go in terms of without going to being a Dreadnought. And remember that Terminator armor is still called Tactical Dreadnought armor in the fluff.
Yep.
But that's going to be the most you're going to get. As well as things like, you know, the assault cannon, the cyclone missile launcher that goes obviously with the Terminator suit,
Chain fist.
Yeah, digital weapons, if you want to go down that path, Infernus pistol, all these sorts of things are going to be requiring Famed. And then for Hero, it's basically just the conversion beamer, artificer armor, and all the relics. All the Chatner relics require Hero, and that's really as far as you can go.
Yeah.
And of course, I think this is with good sense, because the conversion beamer is ridiculous.
Well, conversion beamers are supposed to be ridiculous.
That's it, yeah.
But
I remember back to the old Space Crusade, and I think you can get conversion beamers in that, couldn't you?
Yeah, I used to have Gene Stealer hybrids with conversion beamers in second edition.
Yeah.
And they had ballistic skill too, which meant that they missed vastly more often than they ever hit anything.
Yeah.
But if you fire enough conversion beamers at your enemy, you're going to kill a lot of things.
That's it.
Yeah.
All right.
Ah, the good old days.
I mean, it's funny because they're ridiculous. They're the best sniper weapon in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and despite the fact they've got blast and that sort of stuff as well, you know, they've got great, fantastic range, you know, so...
Yeah, further you are, the better they are.
Well, that's like, what was it, your character in Dark Heresy that you sniped with an assault cannon, was it?
No, autocannon.
Autocannon,
yeah. Autocannon on single shot mode.
Yeah, because the range just made it...
The range made it worthwhile.
Yeah, that's it. All right, so let's talk about honours now, specifically. So honours are awards, or even really tokens. Like every single honor can be displayed. So I guess think of it as a modern day medal in the military as such. You know, they signify particular acts as such. Now, they're all covered by and large in rites of battle. So we'll go through the most basic honors. Now, this is by no means the whole extent of Space Marine honors. You know, you can make up your own ones. They could be chapter-specific, they could be campaign-specific.
Oh, there's loads more in some of the fluff, in some of the books. You're gonna be able to find lots of those.
That's it. I mean, the most common one, and we've mentioned a few times already, that people will know, is the Crux Terminatus.
Yeah.
Which is basically the award that a Marine must receive before they are ever eligible to use Terminator armor, before they can be seconded to the first company of their chapter. You know, it's the final point before that.
Yes.
Now, there is some dispute in the book. At one point, it refers to the character needing to be Famed level to get the Crux Terminatus, whereas everything that it gives you access to, i.e. Terminator armor, etc., runs off of the... Oh, sorry, no, it's always fame. Sorry, that's right. But some of it runs... It mentions Distinguish a couple of times, which is too low to be able to use Turner Armor. So, but I'm pretty sure that Famed is a requirement, or rank 4, renowned rank 4, to be able to get the Crux Terminatus. And then there's not a lot of specification as to what actual deeds warrant it. But I think that the advice to a GM would be wait till your characters hit that famed level, you know, don't try and give it to them beforehand, and then look for some deed which stands out entirely for that character.
Yeah.
At that level. You know, they have the eyes of their superiors, and then they do something fantastic, and they're now eligible for the Crux Terminatus. But yeah, also
keep in mind that, you know, Terminator honors doesn't mean that the character will be wearing Terminator armor.
It just means they can.
Definitely.
And I mean, you've always sort of cautioned when it comes to giving out the Crux Terminatus because of how powerful Terminator armor is.
It's powerful stuff. I mean, obviously, it certainly limits the tactical flexibility. You're not going to be running anywhere particularly fast or dodging anything, but it is still hugely high armor levels.
Yeah.
It's powerful, powerful stuff.
I actually recall an earlier edition of the War Game rules where armor had a base save and weapons had an armor penetration, which would modify the save.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Terminator armor was 2+ on 2d6.
It's 3+ on 2d6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because you could fail against a really naff weapon.
Oh, okay.
With snake eyes, but that was it. That was the only way.
All right. All right, so some of the other rewards. The Aquila token is basically given to a Marine by an Imperial Guard or Imperial Navy commander just to recognize their service to that particular unit. Yep. Likewise, the Army badge is basically just recognizes service with a particular, you know, unit/chapter/ in a particular campaign. It's just, you know, it's that typical he was there badge as well, or medal. Now, the Imperial Laurel, which is usually the green laurel you'll see on veteran Marines in the war game, is basically given for some great act of valor. And that's usually why it's only applied to veterans, because they've, you know, had that... That's why they're veterans. They've been able to engage in some severe act of valor in the past.
Yep.
The Imperialis is an odd one. Basically, this recognizes the fact that at some point the Marine was subject to temptation and chose not to give in and remain loyal instead. It seems odd, because I would think that if the Marine had an opportunity for temptation and gave in, that their career would be very different and probably very short.
Yeah, it seems a bit odd to have a reward. It's sort of like a, you know...
I guess it depends on what level of temptation there was. You know, he was tempted to not feed the cat one night before going to bed because he was a bit tired, you know, or he was tempted to join the forces of Slaanesh, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there, but...
It certainly seems like one which was designed to give to your psychers.
That's it. Now, the Iron Skull and Iron Halo sort of go hand in hand. The Iron Skull is given to a Marine of rank Sergeant or above, and pretty much just signifies the fact that they have showed excellent leadership. Likewise, the Iron Halo is the same thing for rank captain or above.
Yeah.
Once again, just exceptional leadership.
Yeah, from the fluff, actually, Iron Halo is essentially the highest level honor you can give a Marine. Yeah. You know, it's even above the Crux Terminatus, because to become a captain, you have to be...
Well, there's only 10 captains in any Codex chapter, so...
Yeah, you have to be a veteran who already has Terminator honors to be eligible to become a captain. And the Iron Halo is... You know, the reward.
Yeah. The Machina Opus, which is specifically for Tech Marines, pretty much recognizes their service to Mars. Likewise, the Prime Helix is for apothecaries, and I guess it recognizes their service to the gene seed of their chapter as such, like, you know, potentially staying to recover the gene seed from a fallen Marine, even in the thick of battle or when, you know, the forces were retreating and such, they might earn the Prime Helix. The Marksman's Honor, it's pretty much just, you did something fantastic ballistically, like, you know, you hit someone with a snapshot at extreme range, you know, in pitch black, you know, hit an opponent in the eye, whatever it might be, that might get you the Marksman's Honors. Purity Seals are pretty ubiquitous throughout 40K. For Marines, they're usually always given by chaplains, and they're just like... they're a blessing, pretty much. You said it before, it's just like the old D&D bless spell. You know, it's just, you know, here's a little benefit for going into combat as such.
Yeah.
And lastly, there's the... Deathwatch has what's called the Skull and Motto. And that's pretty much just when... It should be awarded by the GM when the GM says, okay, they've just done something freaking awesome. I need to recognize that. But it doesn't fit with any of the other honors. There's no other honor that... I mean, usually you'll find there is one, but if there's not, if they've done something that was just fantastic and you want to reward that, but there's no honor present, then just the Skull and Motto is a good option.
Yeah.
So I guess the important thing is that with the exception of the Crux Terminars, which has a specific rank requirement, most of these honors are given for very subjective reasons. You know, things like, you know, a great act of valor or service to a particular unit, that sort of thing. So I think as a GM, it's important to dole these out from time to time to recognize what the characters have done. You know, I think that they are a nice little thing to add to your character to say you've earned this. You know, some characters will, you know, I make my character day and I say, well, my path is in rank 6, I want to do first company veteran as an alternate career, which means I need to get the Crux Terminus by that point, I guess. So when you are building a color, it's worth, you know, talking with the GM to make sure that they feel the same way about honors. So,
yep.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it for renowned honors. Unless there's anything else you wanted to say?
Not really. Actually read the fluff about what the honor looks like and
yeah.
Go into detail with that.
And go, there's benefits as well. Each honor has various benefits. So,
yeah, and certainly through. Play up when it's actually awarded to the characters because, you know, this is pretty much all that Marines get. They don't get parades. They don't get, you know, adoring fans or anything, really.
Yeah.
They get a shiny medal every so often when they've done something above and beyond. So, you know, really play it up.
That's it. All right, so let's move on to our career discussion.
Yes.
All supplicants report to the Administratum for career assignment.
So for today's career or specialty discussion, we're going to be talking about the Tactical Marine.
Yeah.
Now, this is a pretty broad topic because the Tactical Marine is probably... They're very hard to define in one particular aspect, I guess. So let's talk about, first off, the role of the Tactical Marine in the Adeptus Astartes in general. And in the past, we've discussed the sort of path that a Marine goes through as they progress through their career as such. They start off as a scout, then they become a Devastator, then an Assault Marine, then a Tactical Marine. So the Tactical Marine is really the... It's hard to say peak, but to become a Tactical Marine... You have to have done every other combat doctrine,
yeah,
and basically be versatile enough to, you know, enter a combat in any number of ways, and you know, persecute a strong campaign in that respect. So you know, they are the versatile Marine trained in all doctrines. Basically, they're well suited to the deployment of what I guess you call support weapons. So not necessarily, you know, your heavy weapons, but things like your plasma gun, melter gun.
Yeah,
you know, grenade launcher, things that
flamers,
give,
yeah, lots of stuff.
Things that give squads more versatility without necessarily relying upon slow, heavy fire.
Yeah,
they're usually well suited to filling command roles. So things like a lot of your sergeants will. I mean, look at say a Devastator squad in the war game.
Yeah.
You know, your sergeant will have either a bolt gun or a bolt pistol and close combat weapon. They're not usually armed with a heavy weapon like every other member of the squad. They effectively are treated like a tactical marine from how they're equipped.
Yeah.
And that's why I see that most sergeants will be people that have had that doctrine experience, that know the doctrine, but are still able to assess the situation from a more versatile tactical role as well.
Yes.
And I guess, as the most experienced Marines, they're probably well suited to guiding newer Marines. You know, both you know, in the scouts, but also Marines that have entered into other doctrines and have yet to sort of, you know, reach their full potential. They can be guided by the Tactical Marines.
Yeah, I think that all fits. And, of course, it's important to remember that all Marines who are Tactical Marines are well-versed in multiple areas of, you know, combat as well.
Mm.
You know, they're going to act... If the chapter they're of is particularly renowned for, you know, commando-style raids and that sort of thing, they're going to be good at that. You know, whatever the chapter's good at, the Tactical Marine is going to be good at.
Yeah, they're an exemplar of their chapter.
They're an exemplar of their chapter, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, so what about the role of the Tactical Marine in Death Watch specifically? Now, When I was thinking about this, I was sort of thinking, okay, well, everything I said before for Stardays really applies here, but I guess their tactical flexibility is more important in the context of a kill team. Because if you think about a squad in a Codex chapter, the squad's usually set up for one particular type of combat.
They're usually supported by other squads.
Yeah, they're close combat, or they're long-range air weapons, or they're close assault, or they're fast attack, whatever it might be. Whereas a kill team is usually made up of a whole bunch of individuals with a variety of doctrines. You know, one assault marine, one devastator marine, one librarian, one apothecary, and a tactical marine. You know, it could be a typical kill team. So I guess that the tactical flexibility of the tactical marine is advantageous here, because what that means is that, you know, if you've got a combat situation where it's clearly going to be, you know, close combat all the time, you know, that the devastator is going to be hanging back or fighting with their combat knife as such, you know, that a tactical marine can, you know, equip themselves with a lot of close in gear and support the assault marine and you know, give themselves that additional boost in that particular aspect that will match the mission.
Yeah.
And I guess so, they're also the ones best suited for leadership roles, just like tactical marines, I think, would usually become sergeants or similar of the regular squad. I think that they are probably the best suited to be the kill team squad leaders in Death Watch as well.
Usually, yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. So what about actually building a tactical marine? This one was pretty tough because, as I mentioned before, you could take it from so many angles.
Yeah, so I think it comes down to there's two ways of doing the characteristics. You can either have all your characteristics sort of around the same level and try and be a bit above average at everything, because, you know, they're Marines. They're going to be above average at everything.
Yeah.
Or you can sort of go for a more focused approach where you specialise on just a couple of your course attributes, which you think are going to be more useful.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to the characteristics side of it, I actually put down fellowship, because out of all the Marines, I think they're the only ones that are really going to be called on to use fellowship, both from a command point of view, but also potentially as a, I guess, quote-unquote, face for the group.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got to actually, you know, engage with Imperial forces or other, and you need to actually make social roles, I think that the tactical Marine might be the best suit for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I also put down intelligence, because if they are leaders, then their scope for developing plans / coming up with solid tactics for the group is going to rely upon their intelligence.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's just whatever you want to do. You know, I do think that a good mix of ballistic skill and weapon skill is going to be important. That means you can fill any combat role.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other ones really come down to what you want to play. If you want to be weapon skill focused most of the time, like, you know, the bolt, pistol and chainsaw type, then maybe weapon skill. If you want to be the hang back fighter like with a bolt gun, then maybe ballistic skill is your better bet.
Yeah.
It comes down to what your preference is, really. You can build the tactical marine how you want to build it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Likewise, skills. There aren't many I really said were specifically tactical marine. And I guess most of what I put down were social skills that no one else would ever buy, or no one else would need to buy, like charm, command, inquiry, scrutiny. Those are all social skills that I think that a tactical marine will really benefit from. But also tactics.
Yeah.
You know, you get one free tactics at character creation, but there's no reason you couldn't buy more.
Yeah.
You know, in order to have a well-versed concept of the different types of battlefields and the different tactics to use. Now, in terms of talents, I sort of had two target types of talents here. One was either leadership-based talents. The other one was pretty much talents that had some benefit on cohesion. So I start off with Era of Authority, straightforward. You can affect more people with your fellowship roles, basically, with your command/charm test, etc.
Yeah.
Calls of Vengeance allows you to spend a full action when a battle brother falls in battle to refill your cohesion pool. So, you know, refilling it from scratch can be pretty good, especially when you've got high-level characters which have a pretty massive cohesion. You know, it's not so important when you've only got 4 cohesion at the start and you're refilled to 4, but when you've got things like 11, 12, 13 points,
yeah,
it is worthwhile doing cohesion.
Yeah.
Combat formation, if you have gone for that intelligent commander, you know, it does allow you to use your intelligence rather than your agility. And also, if you can communicate the rest of your squad, they can do that as well. They can use your intelligence to do their initiative.
Yeah.
Double team, I think it's one of those sort of talents that gives them their versatility. You know, they can be in there fighting in close combat with the assault marine and not only engage some enemies, but also give a numerical advantage to the assault marine, for example.
Yeah.
Exemplar of Honor allows you to spend fate to regain cohesion, so these are one of those ones I point out as being good for cohesion. Honor Discipline into the Jaws of Hell, of course the rest of your squad aren't your minions, but you know there will be times when you do have minions, whether it's an Imperial Guard detachment or what it might be, and those groups are particularly prone to failure of social roles, like, you know,
pinning and fear.
That's it, yeah. So yeah. Being able to lead those forces can be advantageous to you.
Yeah.
Master Orator, once again, just basically opens up the amount of people that are affected by your social skills and what they have to do. And the last one I put down was Unbound and Unbroken. So this allows you to, the round after you receive a cohesion loss, to perform some act of defiance and reduce that to cohesion loss. So, you know, it could be that you are, you know, pinned by sniper fire. So your character just stands up in, you know, among all the fire and just rains bolt of fire down on the area around where the sniper appears to be, and that, you know, restores some cohesion to your group.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was it for talents. I mean, there's lots of other talents you might use in terms of combat talents, but these are ones I thought that fit some of the motif of the Tactical Marine specifically.
Yeah, I think for talents, it'll probably fit more to what chapter you are than any of the others. So sort of, you know, if you're a space wolf, you'll probably want to aim more for the sort of space wolf style talents.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Speaking of that, chapter choices. For a tactical marine, it's, you know, any chapter will do, you know, because they've got so many good choices there. There's not really, it's hard to say that this chapter is well suited towards it. That being said, I will. There's only two, I think, you know, stand out above all the rest for tactical marines. One of which is Space Wolves, you just mentioned, because they're basically the only chapter which gets a bonus to fellowship, you know, for their gregariousness.
Yeah.
So if you are looking at playing a Space Wolf, you know, Tactical Marine might be a good choice. And of course, the other one is Ultramarines. Now, usually we say Ultramarines because you can have the plus two in any, or have the plus three two categories, plus five to two different characteristics, which means you can use that to build the character you want. But also, the Favored Son ability they get gives them an addition to the squad's cohesion as well.
Yeah.
So I know that when I was playing around with an Ultramarine, Tactical Marine in the past, I was trying to make the highest possible cohesion I could at character creation. So
yeah.
They're worth considering. Otherwise, just pick the talent. This is a bit of talent. Pick the chapter you like, because I can guarantee you that they will make a good Tactical Marine.
Yeah.
In terms of the advanced specialities, there's lots of choice. You know, pretty much, unless they are specifically set up for close combat or they have psychic powers, you can almost say that any particular advanced specialty is good for tactical marines. But some that I put down, Deathwatch Chaplain.
Yep.
They're probably the best. Short of, I mean, we mentioned the Chaplain before with playing an Apothecary. You could also go Chaplain, but I think that it would be more commonplace to see a tactical marine become a Chaplain in that respect. The Deathwatch Keeper, probably not as fun as a player character, because they're sort of, their shtick is to stand around the Watch Fortress in a, almost in a guard capacity. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So probably less fun for a kill team point of view, but also decent for Tactical Marines. Once again, they come with command, up to plus 20. So at rank 1, you've got the Deathwatch Kill Marine. Now, we've spoken about this fellow in the past. Yes. Potentially a good choice if you're mixing Deathwatch with other game settings.
Yep, yep.
But I mean, how do you think a kill marine fits into a kill team?
For a tactical marine, it kind of makes sense, because as we mentioned, I mean, the whole point of tactical marines is they work in a squad. You've got, say you've got two squads on the battlefield, will devastate a squad, and a tactical marine squad will act as some sort of fire support or protection screen for the devastators. If it's a tactical squad, an assault squad, they'll act as some sort of heavy fire support for the assault squad. It allows one character to do that same sort of thing. They can support an entire squad on their own.
Yeah, that's it.
And really, that's what they're for. Yeah, you know, the rest of the squad's doing one thing, and you need it's a two squad operation. You've only got one squad. It allows you to do two squad operations.
Yeah. All right. The Death Watch Watch Captain. So coming off of the concept that, you know, tactical marines will usually be sergeants or captains, then this is the opportunity to sort of be a captain of the Death Watch as well.
Yep.
The first company veteran, you know, so I think that if you want to have Terminator armor, that you couldn't go wrong with a tactical marine. They're a good choice for that, and they got options to them there. And along those same lines, a Deathwing Terminator, if you happen to be a Dark Angel.
Yep.
You know, you want to go for that specific Deathwing group as well. Go to the Rock to learn your skills as such. So,
yeah.
Yep. Okay, for Space Wolves, you've got the Wolf Scouts as a rank one option, and the Wolf Priests that basically fill the role of an apothecary slash chaplain for the Space Wolves. That's it. Yep.
Plus, they've got an awesome model.
Yeah, fantastic model and fantastic artwork in the book as well. So, yeah. And then finally, the Tyranic War Veteran. If you're an Ultramarine, you know, they, looking at their abilities, they have that sort of trait where if they're normally equipped with a bolt gun, they now get assault weapons. If they're normally equipped with assault weapons, they now get long-range weapons. They are built around the concept of versatile warfare against an opponent, which is both, you know, close-in and long-range combat and such. So,
yeah.
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 All right, so what about a few tips on playing a tactical marine? I basically always remember to add that versatility. You know, look for ways that you can fill gaps in the team's skill set, or if the skill set is full, look at ways to buff a particular component of the skill set which will be required for the upcoming mission.
Yeah.
If there's no one else who's better for command in a particular mission or endeavor, then you're probably the best person to put your hand up, because you'll probably generate the highest cohesion pull as such, you know. So, you know, obviously if the mission involves tracking down a rogue psyker, then maybe the librarian's going to be best for that. But if it's just a general mission, you can always default to the
tactical marine.
And I guess, coming back to the cohesion, look for ways to strengthen the cohesion of the group. Look for abilities, for traits, for spot and time abilities, which actually add to cohesion, so that yeah, the group's always effective, and you can always keep using those squad and solo mode abilities, so, yeah.
Yep.
All right.
I'd agree with all that.
So that's probably it for the Tactical Marine. Shall we move on to our review?
Yes.
Okay.
My lord, the information you requested is now available for your review.
So for today's review, we're going to be doing The Emperor's Chosen for Death Watch. Now, Mike hasn't had a chance to read this book before, so it's going to be pretty much me reviewing it.
Yes.
And I have to say, this is my Radical's Handbook, Mike.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think that the biggest...
You make me feel upset for not reading it now.
I think my biggest issue going into it was I had a very high expectation.
Okay.
It was sort of sold as... I mean, okay, it says on the front, Guide to the Veterans of the Jericho Reach. So my thought was, it's sort of like, is this like Ascension for Death Watch? Is this the book that's going to take my Death Watch Marines to that next tier of advancement as such? And I mean, I came across as underwhelmed. Like, I don't want to be unfair. So it's very similar to Radical's Handbook in that the fluff in it is just fantastic. But the execution is all the things that I hate in role playing, and the systems in it seem to be unnecessary. They're there just to create more systems. But I'll go through in detail anyway, and we'll talk about the book that way, and I'll spare you rendering a review for a book you haven't read, Mike. I'll just give it a review at the end. But
Okay,
so chapter one is Only in Death. And this is basically a really good fluff chapter. Yeah, there's absolutely no rules in this section. It's just fantastic information about what it means to be a veteran of the, you know, not only for characters, but to be among veterans and what a veteran is to the Death Watch, you know, about the heroic deeds. It creates a lot more. I mean, it's one of those things where you really want to be playing in the Jericho Reach, because it sort of talks a lot about some of the key features of the Jericho Reach, like the fact that most the Marines there, most of the forces there, have no concept of the fact that there is the Necrons of in the area as well. Like they're not covered in the main book, they're not covered in some other books, you know, but there is a Necron presence in the Jericho Reach.
Yep.
And it's sort of like one of those best kept secrets and such, you know. So overall, I mean, this chapter was really my favorite chapter because, you know, the fluff you can't beat. But it there's never anything wrong with the fluff in any of these books, you know, because the 40K fluff, we just love, you know. We're big fans of the setting and the storylines, and it's great to play games in it. So any book which expands upon those settings and concepts is great. Then we move to Chapter 2, which is Honor Thy Ancestors. So this chapter is basically a whole bunch of, I guess you could call it stories. So stories about individuals in the Jericho Reach historically that have done great things. Usually it talks about not only the person, but also their support structure. So their group or their faction or their team, whatever it might be. You know, it talks about what they've done. And then it will usually end off with a group of stats for items that will become relic of that person. You know, so this person did blah, blah, blah against the Tyranids and has been lost to the warp / died. And so here's the stats for their mega relic device as such, you know.
Yeah.
So we've talked a bit about it in the past. One thing that I hate in role-playing is when you play a game that the GM has played before and the GM decides to, you know, bring in their old character into the game they're now running just because it's their last great chance to play that character or because they want to show off how good their old character was, you know. And Mike's brother used to do it all the time. We'd play games and he'd bring along a character that was from his last time he played the game and that character would come in and absolutely, you know...
Save the day.
And we'd like, and we'd say, well, that really sucked. That wasn't really us. And he'd be saying, oh, no, but this gives you a chance to see what a powerful character can do. And this book, this chapter, for me, smacks of that. It's like, you know, no matter how good you are, here are a whole bunch of guys that have done so much more. Yeah, and I really wonder, you know, do you want to play a game of following in the footsteps of giants? You know, we talked about it before when we mentioned once the Margaret Weiss publishing Marvel superhero system, where they chose to make it so that you could only play the, you know, the classic Marvel superheroes because no one wants to play Marvel in a setting and not be able to be one of the, you know, just be a second string to the X-Men or Spider-Man or the Avengers, whatever, you know, like in this, do you want to just be the person who is seeking the relic of XYZ hero? And then it comes, then it's the whole thing of concept of relics again. Like, I mean, this chapter has a whole bunch of relics. So how do you handle relics in your game as a GM? Do you allow only one character to have a relic? You know, so the relic becomes something special then, in which case is it unbalanced? Will people feel upset that they didn't get that sort of level of gear? Or do you have it so that every member of the group can sort of find their relic? So the, you know, the Devastator finds his relic heavy weapon, the Tatooine Marine finds his relic, whatever, that something. And suddenly relics become this thing where it's like they're commonplace almost all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So this chapter for me was, look, it's got good fluff once again. Like the stories themselves are great. It's just felt like I don't want to use any of this in my game. You know, I don't mind stats for new relics, but each relic is basically the outcome of 8 pages of story about an individual and their deeds and their followers and that sort of thing, you know. And, I don't know. It's just the way I felt about it anyway when I read it. And keep in mind, I have run Deathwatch having had this book and I have not used any of this material. Maybe if I use the material, I might find it was really fun to use, but I didn't use it because the book left me a little bit dry.
Yeah, I did have a flick through this chapter. I've only had a flick through it and read some of the relics. And the biggest issue I saw was that there are so many of them.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if you've got this many relics and you're putting this many in, they're going to start to feel a bit commonplace. And relics should never feel commonplace.
That's it. All right, so chapter 3, Fingers of Legend. This is basically your rules chapter. So this is a new option for high-level characters in Deathwatch where the whole kill team can choose to buy into a legendary path as such, you know. So these paths themselves have an XP cost which must be paid by every member of the kill team. And they open up new combat doctrines, so you get some for free.
Yep.
Plus you have to actually buy some as well.
So it's sort of like...
It's like the cell directives in
Dark Heresy. Cell directives from Dark Heresy,
Now, to be honest, I would have preferred it if it was more like cell directives.
Ah.
It feels like okay, let's bring in a new system for the sake of having a new system. You know, it doesn't add more ranks to the characters. It's just an alternate way of buying more combat doctrines and maneuvers that require commitment from the entire group. And you know, what happens if everyone wants to accept one person who doesn't want it? Are they bullied into spending, you know, what's usually like, say, 1,000 XP to buy their way into the sort of skill set, which they're never going to take any more points from as such. So,
yeah.
Look, the rules themselves are sound. And some of the concepts of the different types of paths are quite good.
Yeah, it sounds familiar to some other games I've seen. Mm. And it always leads to the same issue of what happens if the group goes, oh, we'll buy this directive and we'll get hold of it. And then all of a sudden the GM has to sort of find ways to work it into his stories in the future, because if he doesn't, the players end up feeling like, well, we just spent, you know, collectively 5,000 XP to buy this thing.
Yeah.
And we haven't used it yet.
That's it, exactly. All right, and chapter 4 is The Longest Watch, which is the module for it. You know, thankfully, we've got a book here that's got a module.
Yep.
And I've read the module, haven't actually run the module. To me, it looks okay. Yeah. It once again, it's one of those storylines which is built on the concept of, as I said before, following in the footsteps of giants. You know, this, the summary goes on about how, you know, this previous group did all these things and then were lost, and now, you know, there's an opportunity for the other player characters to follow in those steps and, you know, achieve great end or recover stuff as well. So, you know, we don't like to go into spoilers and such, but for me, it was good. I'd be interested to run this module. If I was running a Death Watch campaign, this would find its way into my rotation. But I would certainly be very careful about how I present it, because, as I said, I don't like to have... I don't mind players coming along and seeing the aftermath or something, but I don't like players coming along and seeing how much better their predecessors were than them.
Yeah.
And them trying to prove themselves to be worthy of, you know, such a name as such. I'd rather they are defined by what they do, not by what they can duplicate others doing as such, you know. So,
yeah.
But yeah, my opinion may change if I actually ran the module.
Okay.
So, look, honestly, all told, not a bad book in terms of, you know, it's not like I put the book down so I can't keep reading this. I just, in that situation where I went, nice fluff, I probably won't use any material from this. That eventually looks good. I'll put that when I've got, you know, when I'm running Death Watch and I've got a slow day and I just want to do a one shot that, you know, we'll give it a go. Yeah. So, in terms of a veteran maneuvers, I'd probably give this book a 6.
A 6,
yeah. You know, because it's still an enjoyable read. You know, the fluff is good, and it's, you know, it's Space Marines, love Space Marines. But it's just, there was, yeah, if someone said to me, you know, I want to buy all the Death Watch books, but I can't afford all, what should I drop? Probably The Emperor's Chosen might be one I'd say, well, look, don't get that unless your budget really, you know, unless you can afford everything. You know, it might be worth, you know, you can certainly start a game of Death Watch without this book.
Okay.
Yeah, and then, you know, you can decide later on whether the veteran options are good for you, and go from there as such. But buy it on PDF, that's a good example. You know, get it to drive through RPG and get it on PDF, and only then can you decide if you want to go and fork out the dollars for the physical copy as well. So,
okay.
I mean, Mike, you haven't read it, but do you have any thoughts on what I've said?
The artwork's nice.
Yeah, the artwork's always nice in these books.
Like I said, I flicked through. I had a glance at a couple of the relics. They seem okay. The only thing is, I noticed that there were quite a lot of relics.
Mm.
And it did feel a bit like, well, are these relics because this person owned it, or were these relics before the person got hold of it? Which raised a couple of questions about what is a relic.
Yeah.
Without actually answering anything. I mean, it doesn't look bad from what I saw, but I haven't really read through it, so yeah. I don't know a lot about it. But the artwork's nice.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you one thing about relics. This comes back to my thoughts on things like the old, say, 3rd edition D&D. Yeah. So when you made, as a GM, if you put together a magical item there, you could say this magical item is a +2 longsword of frost with the keen trait.
Yeah.
You know, and you can give that to the player character, so that's exactly what it is. Or if you do that, you might say, okay, well, I'm going to call this sword Frost Razor because it's very sharp and it, you know, it constantly oozes cold from the edge of the razor sharp blade. And that gives it more sort of character. And so the question would be if your player characters pick up Frost Razor versus they pick up a +2 cold longsword with the keen trait, is there more or less in that for them as such? And I think that the relics in this book have a lot of character to them. So if you did choose to incorporate one of these relics...
Yeah, it's a little bit different from D&D, though, because if you decide to sell your +2 keen frost sword or sell Frost Razor, there's no social stigma attached for selling it or losing it or breaking it, whereas for Marines, there most certainly is.
Well, coming back to my point before about how you do relics, whether everybody gets one or only one person gets one, and is that balanced? I could see what you could do with these relics in this book is say, okay, well... Someone says to the kill team, look, the such-and-such of such-and-such has been located, but it's in enemy hands. We need you to recover it and bring it back so we can stick it in the Omega Vault.
Yeah.
Yeah, and...
obviously, so, you can use it when you find it.
That's it, yeah.
Fight
right.
So, your way out with it.
Yeah, that's it. So the player character... So if someone gets to wield it, it's a single relic that only one person in the group gets, but that it's a short-term thing.
Yeah, that sounds great, except for the fact that some of these relics are armour.
Yes.
You're not going to get into an enemy stronghold, strip down naked, put on someone else's clothes and fight your way back out. It just seems a bit... Yeah.
Yeah, but... Yeah, I guess there's options there either way. It actually reminds me of the hammer from the Ultramarines movie, you know, where it's sort of like they spend the whole time just venerating the hammer in its sort of ensconced position and such, and then only at the very end of the film go, well, hey, you know what? This would be pretty good to use against a demon, you know. It happens to be a demon right here, you know, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But anyway, look, I'm not going to say it's a bad book. I'm just going to say that I was, maybe my expectations, but maybe I've, you know.
So it's no Juicer's Handbook is what you're saying.
That's no Juice. Oh, God, that's a poor riff reference. yeah, I think I had, because, look, I loved Ascension.
Yeah.
And I sort of went in thinking this might be Ascension for Death Watch and, you know, I just disappointed myself, but yeah, it was just the way I felt. So you've got your Radicals Handbook, I've got my Empress Chosen.
Yeah.
Alright, no worries. Let's move along.
Okay.
Ignorance is a blessing. The data you requested is unavailable.
So for today's final discussion, we're going to have a talk about managing downtime, you know, because I'm sure we'd all like to be role-playing 24/7, but, you know, we've all got day jobs and lifetimes and families, and we kind of get together to role play every fortnight, every month, every 6 weeks, whatever it may be.
Yep.
And there's a lot of time that we're not gaming.
Yep.
And I guess that there's various ways that you can make use of that time. There are various ways you can actually still engage in your hobby while not being actively engaged in your hobby.
Yep.
And I guess the most common concept here comes back to the idea of blue booking. And blue booking as a role-playing thing was first sort of put forward in an old Champions book called Strike Force by Aaron Alston, where I think the blue book concept was based upon the old exam books that they used to use in US schools, where you'd fill out all the answers from the exam, hand it back to the teacher. The teacher would then, you know, mark it and hand you back your results and such. And that was sort of the same idea with the blue book, was it something that you could exchange between yourself and the GM in order to propagate what your character was doing as well, you know. So, and I think the concepts have changed a bit since then, but let's look at the base concept of blue booking, what it allowed you to do. It allowed you to put into words things about the character that you may not necessarily bring into the game, all right? So things like the character's thoughts, you know, unless your character is the sort of person to stand there and give off an internal monologue externally, you know, like, you know, 1920s, you know, noir detective style.
Or The Tick.
Yeah, or The Tick, that's true, yeah, which we were watching last night. Then, you know, it's a good opportunity to actually describe the way that your character thinks is by putting their thoughts onto paper.
Yeah.
It allows you to engage in private conversations, so conversations you don't want to have at the table. And to be honest, one common type used in blue booking, I guess, is when... the character might be having a conversation that you're uncomfortable to have at the table. You know, it might be a conversation with someone of a romantic or intimate nature as such that, you know, you're going to get mocked for if you actually try and do that in front of a bunch of your mates around the role playing table, you know.
Yeah.
It can be a way to show past scenes. So sort of history from your character's life. I mean, I'll give you one example here. So many years ago, I was playing in a friend's Dungeons & Dragons campaign. And I was playing a paladin. And at one point between games, I decided to write a letter in character. And the letter was supposed to be between the character and the character's father. And it was supposed to be... So the character's writing to the father because the last time they spoke, it was... the father disagreeing with the character's choice to go out for a life of adventuring and thinking they should stay home and, you know, continue the family trade, farming, whatever it might be, you know, and that sort of remorse over their final words being an argument, and that the letter ended off with the character acknowledging that they would never send this letter because they just received word that the father had died, but they still felt the need to write it down as though they were going to send it just to get those words onto paper. And I sent that to the GM, and she was like, oh, you know, this is really good, a really good characterization as such, you know. But yeah, I mean, it didn't add anything to the plot of the game. You know, it didn't progress the storyline of the game. It was just, you know, an activity which gave some depth to the character's background and their motivations. And I guess if I played the character differently in the next session and the other player characters understand why, at least the GM knew... you know, why, you know, the other players could wonder why the character suddenly seemed so morose, but, you know, the GM knew. So that was one example of how I used the concept of blue booking, you know. And finally, it's good just for asking questions of the GM. You know, questions you forgot to ask at the table, don't want to ask at the table, you know, like, you know, can I start working on a plan to kill Mike's character, you know, whatever it might be.
How do I start going about performing this demonic pact?
That's right, yeah, that's right, exactly right, yeah. And I mean the royal Mike here, not necessarily this Mike, you know. It's just an example player
name. Example Mike,
that's
yes.
Right, yeah, Mike Smith, yeah. Yeah. So, have I missed anything in terms of the concept of the original concept of blue booking?
No, that pretty much covers it. The other part of it is that there's big sections of what happens in game that isn't covered on a table. I mean, between missions, especially for Dark Heresy, that you've got your huge travel times in the warp for all of them, of the 40k games, Rogue Trader especially. It gives you a chance to actually fill out what your characters do to fill that time.
That's it.
The GM may say, okay, you know, anyone who wants to, there's an extra 100 XP in it if you give me, you know, an idea, a well-detailed idea,
yeah,
about what your character actually does to fill time for the next 3 months.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess what you don't want to do is write down my character went to the loo.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff happens off camera. But it still doesn't need to be described as such. You know?
Exactly.
You should probably, when you do blue booking, the advantage of it is when you actually add depth to the setting, to the character, or to the group.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that actually, you know, creates more, because generally speaking, the only people that read it will be yourself and the GM. So what are the two of you going to get out of it? You know, so. Going back to my example when I wrote the story of my character's letter, that for me wasn't to... My intent there wasn't to write something that would entertain the GM or even to get extra XP. My intent there was simply just... I think I'm going to write something from the point of view of the character and just see how it goes, because that will help me round out the character's personality more as such.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You want to create things that the GM can use as well. For example, if you put down in your blue booking that your character... you know, goes through and carves the name of all the other PCs into bolt rounds, which they're going to be carrying with them.
Yeah.
Not necessarily to ever use, but just in case.
Just in case, yeah.
And then in a later scene, the other characters search that character's belongings for whatever reasons. If they find those bolt shells, the GM can certainly add them in, because they exist, they've been added in the blue booking, the other characters don't know. And then the players might go, well, the GM's just said these things exist... you know, what are we going to do about this? And it adds extra dimensions in that regard as well.
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, using your example of the ship in transit, you know, you could say things like, you know, my character spends a lot of time playing regicide against the captain and such, you know, but that means that they mean, okay, well, the GM might say, well, okay, we haven't really defined much about the captain, but obviously this character has a relationship with him, so I'm going to choose to flesh out the concept of that character so that they may appear as an ally in the future as such, you know, or, you know, when they turn up years from now, they can say, oh, I miss our games of Regicide, that sort of thing. So, yeah,
definitely. And also it gives the GM a good opportunity to get an idea of generally where the characters, the player and the character are aiming. Because if the character's, you know, describing all these things they're doing and it's stuff that you've never thought to add into your game, you may want to consider, well, actually, maybe I can add those sort of aspects into the game and see how it goes.
Yeah. I think the sort of nature of blue booking has changed recently, or recent years, in the last couple of decades, because of the internet.
Oh, definitely.
You know, so the once again, the term of blue booking comes out of the idea that I would write it in a piece of, you know, in a book and hand it to the GM for them to read and hand back to me with their comments. Nowadays, yeah. You know, this is all done by email. That's it. Yeah, you know, or you know, you put it onto, you know, Google Drive, whatever, that sort of stuff. You know, you have a shared document somewhere that you both add to. And
there's certainly also the other option that you could set up for your game, a forum or something, just for all the players. And that way all the players can see the blue booking.
Yeah.
So there's no reason not to. And it'll let other characters other players get a better feel for other characters in the game. And it'll help build relationships and give them more of an idea of ways they can play in the games off of each other.
Hopefully your groups mature and they understand the difference between in-character knowledge and out-of-character knowledge, you know, and they can play like that as well. So, but I mean, I think it's certainly advantageous to have that sort of availability to you as well.
Yeah, definitely.
That's it. And I guess the most important thing about blue booking is that it's a way for you to keep playing your character even when you're not sitting around the gaming table.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are still, you might only be writing, but you are playing your character, you know. So I remember when we were running The Unbound, so this was for those who aren't familiar, our multi sort of format was both LARP and tabletop and war game from a single narrative, and each group in the game was basically a rogue trader crew. And we had a couple of crews that would literally say, hey, just so you guys know, we're getting together on Sunday for an in-character session. We don't need a GM, because we're not going to be doing any sort of roles or major stuff. All we want to do is get together and talk in character about what our plans are, about what our mission is, about whatever else we plan, how we plan to screw the other crews over. And it was really, as a GM, as a writer of that game, it was really nice to sort of hear that people were so keen on the game, they were looking for ways to play the game even when we weren't available to run it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was really good. All right, you mentioned something there earlier I want to talk about as well, where you said, okay, well, if you do a really good job, we'll give you 100 XP. This is a common thing when it comes to blue booking, is that GMs will often look to reward players who put the extra effort in to produce this sort of material.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Mike, what are your thoughts on that first off?
To be honest, XP probably wouldn't be my first choice.
Yeah.
I would only give XP rewards if everybody was blue booking. If you've got a collection of, you know, you've got five players around the table, three of them are really keen for it, and two of them are completely non-writers, aren't interested in the slightest. In which case, you're going to get an uneven curve amongst your players, and the two who aren't writing and aren't taking part might feel a little bit left out or a little bit, you know, underappreciated.
Yeah.
So probably a better method of rewards, if you want to use rewards, is in-character stuff that happens in the games. Those characters who do take part in the blue booking will probably have a greater immersion. But again, that can have drawbacks as well, because then the characters who aren't taking part might start to feel like supporting cast.
Yeah. And that, I mean, let me give you another example in this case. Years ago, I was running a D&D campaign. It's actually, this is a precursor to The Unbound. This was a D&D LARP.
Yeah.
Fantasy LARP, you know, not a runaround Boffert LARP. It was more of a social game LARP as such. But one of the people who'd been there from the very start and had a character which was a relatively major role. So you're talking about, first off, a kingdom, and the character was playing, or the player was playing, the character was the princess as such, you know. So they used to have some players who'd say, well, she gets limelight because she's an important figure, but we'd also try and do enough material that wasn't based around that court as well, you know. Anyway, but she and I used to email a lot at work, because at that point in time, we both had jobs that were pretty
menial,
you know, pretty menial, and it was like, you know, bums in seats sort of thing, you know. And so
yeah,
we literally got to the point where we were actually I was running scenes for the character, you know, during the workday as such, you know, and we just back and forth on the email. And I always was very clear, like, that you're not going to get any XP or any awards just because the other people don't have access to this as such. But I certainly saw it. We'd get together for a game and they'd be talking about, you know, what's been going on, and someone would say, oh, I did this, and this. And everyone would be like, well, I don't remember that. When did that happen? You know, because, you know, a month has passed in game since the last meeting, but as far as I'm also concerned, that's just been a month of doing nothing.
Yeah.
And this person has clearly been off having adventures and doing other stuff. And I don't know if they necessarily thought it was unfair or complain about it, but once again, you're right. I think they did feel like, okay, well,
supporting cast.
Yeah, that's it. Clearly, this person is getting the lion's share of the story, and I'm just here for a, you know, a once a month bit of excitement as such. So,
But I think that probably the best reward you can give is using what they give you in the blue booking in your games. If they create an NPC that they talk about or something like that, bring it into the game. That will probably be reward enough.
Yeah, and I guess almost something to note, if you're a player and you're thinking of blue booking, a way to endear yourself to the GM is to incorporate facets of the GM's world that they've described into your blue book as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so
bring up NPCs they've mentioned before.
Yeah, or parts of their own storyline. Yeah, I think that a couple of years ago, Mike started to run a campaign of Twilight 2013, which is like a post-apocalyptic survival game as such, and Mike had done all this work to write this background about what had been the root cause of the global nuclear war that had led to the apocalypse as such, and we all sort of made our characters, and some of us actually submitted like character stories, backstories, and, you know, we'd try to incorporate, you know, key events that were described in Mike's background as such, you know, and some players did, some players didn't as such. But I think from, and Mike, you would have felt, as a GM, you would have felt better if people had actually obviously read and understood and utilised the material that you'd written in their own backgrounds as well.
Yeah, it certainly made it easier to bring them into the story and actually get some interaction as well.
Yeah. But I think that is a key consideration, that you will find that there'll be players who are mad keen to blue book, and players are not so keen. And it may even not be a matter of being keen. It may be a matter of being having the time available.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people I know who role play are also academics or students as such, you know, and when it comes to, you know, they've just sat down and written a 9,000-word essay for university. They don't want to now go down and write a bunch of, you know, prose for their character as well. You know,
yeah,
you can't punish them for that as well.
That's it. Yeah. As a GM, you can never make it feel like it's a chore.
Yeah.
If they do or if they don't, that's their choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, a common thing that I would see in the past is that, you know, we'd have forums where people were doing in-character writing, and someone at a game later would refer to, oh, you remember when we had that? Remember when I had that conversation? And other people were like, oh, look, I don't get a chance to read the forums.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you do Blue Book and put it out there, don't assume that your audience will have time to read it. You know, between games, like, you know, I mean, even the GM, you know, like, send it to the GM, but if they come to the game and say, look, I don't have a chance to read what you wrote, you know, don't get uppity about it. You know, it's just a case of, you know, role playing is a hobby, not a job.
Yeah.
So, you know, enjoy it in your own time, basically.
Absolutely.
I guess one last thing I want to say is a good resource for this sort of style of gameplay is a website called Obsidian Portal. And I'll put a link to Obsidian Portal in our show notes. This is basically a site where you can host your campaign. So the GM can basically create a page for it. They can say what game system it's under. If they're looking for players, they can use it as a recruiting point as well.
Yep.
But it allows you to put down, create characters, or not so much create games, but put the character information. You can put a wiki in to your site. You can put in historical notes. So you can put in your character's backstories, your conversations, all the things we mentioned about blue booking. You can choose to share it just with the GM or with other players. The GM can share things with individuals as well, and it's a free resource too.
Yeah,
very good site. You can, I think, you can also pay for an Ascended option, which I think I'm an Ascended member there, which gives you some more control as a GM. But yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. A good way to, as we said before, keep playing your character even when you're not at the gaming table. So, anything else you want to say, Mike, on this?
Not really. I think that's about everything.
Okay. Well, let's move on to closing out the show.
Yep.
All astropaths to the choir chamber. Message incoming.
So, welcome to our community section. First off, I want to say a quick thank you to everybody who has reviewed and liked our show.
Yep.
I couldn't find any new reviews this week, but I'm sure that people are still out there talking about us because we're getting more and more likes on Facebook and on Google+. So if you've been in any way promoting our show, we really do thank you. Getting more and more listeners is really great for us, and we're just hoping that people enjoy the show and keep listening anyway. So absolutely. I think in the last couple of weeks we had our first unlike on Facebook.
Yeah?
Yeah, so somebody always decided that they weren't buying what we were selling.
But they suck.
And they'll never know because they will have moved on by now. All right, so...
Well, no.
Also, thank you to everybody who's in some way commented or contacted us. I got to admit, I've been a bit slack about replying to comments on our various pages since getting back from Gen Con because I've been catching up with work. There was a bit of a disaster while I was away last week. I've been having to sort of sweep up at work, but that's all right. But we did get some contacts this week. First off, from our friend Matt Lee via Facebook. Had some comments about the last episode where we talked about the missionaries.
Yep.
He also pointed out, along with the other sort of users that we put down with the missionary, they're also one of the three, along with the Archmilitant and Explorator, one of the three careers that gets Medicaid.
Yep.
As a skill. So if you didn't have an Explorator or an Archmilitant, they might be good for your healing side, along with the pure faith abilities as well of healing.
Yep.
He also suggested that we did mention the Drusian Adherent as a potential alternate career for them. He sort of felt that the Drusian Adherent was a better way of giving the flavour of a missionary to a different career rather than...
I'd probably agree with that. Yeah. It's a better way of making other characters feel sort of more ecclesiarchal, sort of, you know, a crusader, arch-militant.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, everything we put down really is just our opinion anyway, you know. Opinions are like arseholes, everyone's got one, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, yeah, Matt puts forward a good case anyway, so.
Yeah.
Also, there's been some discussion on our Google+ page regarding last episode. The comments we made about when we spoke to Tad, and Tad was talking about the way that he distributes critical hits, or his GM has distributed critical hits across the body in order to avoid the case of one point of damage to the foot killing you when all the other damage you take is to the body, you know.
Yeah.
And so Sean posted some comments there, and Tad has also posted some comments. You know, feel free to get onto Google+ and have a look there, just various ways about their thoughts on that idea and how it's actually worked in the system. Also, when it comes to ways to find other players, Tad also mentioned sites like Roll20, where you can actually get into some digital online games as well. Like we mentioned before, Obsidian Portal as well.
Yeah, yeah.
These are good ways of also finding more players. So if you are looking to contact the show, there's a ton of ways you can do it. One is via our website, which is www.grimdarkpodcast.com, via our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/grimdarkpodcast, via our Google+ page, which is plus.google.com/+grimdarkpodcast. We tweet at grimdarkpodcast, and you can also email us at show@grimdarkpodcast.com. Our forums are still online at darkrain.org/community. And you can also leave some voicemail for us on our website. So jump onto the website, click on the send voicemail link and record a bit of message for us, and we'll play it on the show and do our best to answer your questions, comments, or abuse.
Yes.
Okay, so what's coming up in episode 24? I think, Mike, you're a bit excited for this one, aren't you?
Yeah, Black Crusade again. So we'll be talking about demon weapons, the Forsaken archetype, and a brief history of 40k itself.
And you're also looking forward to the review of Tome of Decay.
And the review of Tome of Decay, yeah, the new book.
Yeah, I saw you brought that with us to the US, and you were devouring that book while we were...
Absolutely. I have to say, I was very happy to see that sold out at Gen Con.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So that was definitely good to see as well.
Yeah, good book. Well, we'll say more about that in 2 weeks' time anyway, so...
Yep.
All right, so thank you once again for listening to us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show. We enjoyed making it, as always. Mike, thank you for joining me once again tonight.
Thank you very much.
And we look forward to catching you up in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
This podcast is not endorsed by or affiliated with Games Workshop or Fantasy Flight Games. Warhammer 40,000, Dark Heresy, Rogue Trader, Death Watch, Black Crusade, Only War, Eternal Crusade, and all associated properties are trademark and or copyright of Games Workshop Limited. Fantasy Flight Games is a trademark of Fantasy Flight Publishing Inc. All other materials are trademark and or copyright of their respective owners. All original content is copyright of the Grimdark Podcast. All rights are reserved by their respective owners. Our theme music comes from Mevio's Media Gallery, music.mevio.com.